Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate State Affairs Committee. We'll call this meeting to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:30 p.m. on Tuesday, March 10th. Let the record also reflect that we have a quorum present today. Our Vice Chair Coghill, Senator Wilson, Senator Kawasaki, and myself, Senator Rivak. Please silence your cell phones. I'd like to also acknowledge Senator Gray Jackson. We have Ms. Carrie Cooper-Ryder from Senate Records. Nate Williams is our moderator, and Betty Tangeman staffing our committee today. Thank you. Today we have three items on the agenda: SB 133, sexual assault examination kits testing, sponsored by Senator L.V. Gray Jackson. We have SB 88, Office of Administrative Hearing, sponsored by Senator Machicki. And SB 231, Village Public Safety Officer Grants, sponsored by Senator Donnie Olson. All right, we'll get started with SB 133, an act relating to testing of sexual assault examination kits and providing for an effective date. This is the second hearing on this bill. Last week we finished public testimony, and I'd like to try and move it from committee today. We have the bill sponsors as well as David Canaris. Forgive me if I butchered your name, sir, Chief of Laboratory Services, Alaska Crime Lab, available for any further questions. Are there any further questions regarding SB 133 from the committee? Seeing none, for the record, the Department of Public Safety has submitted a $540,000 fiscal note. And with that, I'd like to gauge the will of the committee. Mr.
Chairman,
Vice Chair.
I move that we move the CS for Senate Bill number 133, State Affairs, from committee. That would be version U with the attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, SB 133 moves from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Back on the record, up next is SB 88, an act relating to the Office of Administrative Hearings. We have invited testimony, and I'd like to invite Michael Willis, legislative intern for Senator Machicki, and retired administration law judge Andrew Hemingway, to please come forward to the table. Please put yourselves on the record and tell us about the bill.
Good afternoon, Chair Rivak and committee members. For the record, my name is Michael Willis. I'm interning for Senator Machicki this session. The senator is unable to attend because he has a membership in CNRA. Senate Bill 88 is a good government bill to improve the process for hearing administrative appeals in Alaska. The bill updates the Office of Administrative Hearing statutes to address due process concerns, procedural confusion, and inefficiencies, all with an eye towards improving OAH's ability to provide timely, cost-effective, and high-quality administrative adjudication services. In 2004, under the leadership of Governor Murkowski and Senator Theriault, the legislature created the Office of Administrative Hearings to centralize the state administrative adjudication process. The new system has worked well to reduce cost, improve public confidence, and provide a speedier process to resolve disputes. However, the statutory framework is in need of an update to correct drafting anomalies and take advantage of the lessons learned from 14 years of test driving the original innovative legislation. Two subject matter experts are present today. Andrew Hemingway, a recently retired administrative law judge, would like to testify on the bill, after which he will be followed by Christopher Kennedy, current administrative law judge and former deputy director of the Office of Administrative Hearings. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Willis. Mr. Hemingway.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. My name is Andy Hemingway. I was employed by the Office of Administrative Hearings as an administrative law judge from the time it was created in 2004 until 2015. And I retired from state service in 2016, and I'm appearing before you in a personal capacity. With your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to provide the members of the committee with some background information regarding the Office of Administrative Hearings in order to put into perspective what the agency does and why this legislation is needed. The Office of Administrative Hearings is, in effect, the executive branch's judicial branch. The agency, OAH, conducts adjudicative hearings for executive branch agencies. These hearings provide due process of law for a member of the public who has the right to appeal from an agency decision regarding that person's state benefit, obligation, or program or license. Before OAH was established, each individual agency conducted these kinds of adjudicative hearings using a hearing officer employed by the agency whose decisions was being appealed. Understandably, this system resulted in a perception among many people who appealed that the proceeding was stacked against them because the agency controlled the adjudicative process and employed the hearing officer. In 2004, the Alaska Legislature created the Office of Administrative Hearings as an independent agency. The purpose of the legislation was to eliminate the perception of unfairness in the adjudicative process and to separate the adjudicatory functions of the executive branch agencies from those agencies' investigative, prosecutorial, and policymaking functions. OAH's jurisdiction is set out in AS 4464030. Since OAH was established, the legislature has added additional case categories to the list of agencies, boards, and commissions whose cases must be heard by OAH. In addition, a number of executive branch agencies and other public entities, such as municipalities and school districts, whose cases are not listed in AS 4464030, have decided to refer their cases to OAH in order to take advantage of what has come to be seen as a professional, experienced, fair, and cost-effective method of resolving contested cases. Today, OAH handles cases from approximately 80 different areas of law. Administrative law judges at OAH have dealt with matters involving as little as $40 to as much as $800 million, as well as cases where money is not the issue, such as professional licensing, ethics, and procurement. Some cases involve teams of attorneys on both sides, while others involve a non-attorney agency representative and a self-represented litigant. In order to provide some context for the specifics of Senate Bill 88, I'll briefly describe the adjudicative process as it occurs in the Office of Administrative Hearings. Let's say a person disagrees with an agency decision regarding a matter such as child support, PFD eligibility, revocation or denial of a professional license, or entitlement to a welfare benefit. Under our Constitution, that person is entitled to an adjudicative hearing to contest the agency's decision. The person files an appeal with the agency, which is required to forward the appeal to OAH within 10 days. From then on, OAH has control of the hearing process. The Chief Administrative Law Judge assigns the case to an administrative law judge who's charged with issuing a proposed decision within 120 days. The assigned judge will review the case file and either schedule a hearing or, in more complex cases, schedule a pre-hearing conference. There may be some preliminary issues to deal with, in which case the parties will be given an opportunity to file pre-hearing motions. In many cases, the administrative law judge will conclude that the issues that have been raised may be capable of resolution without a hearing through alternative dispute resolution. In those cases, the chief administrative law judge will assign a different judge to contact the parties and to conduct mediation, which is an informal, voluntary process in which the judge attempts to find a workable solution to the issues raised that satisfies both the individual and the agency. This has been a particularly beneficial part of the OAH docket, which has saved agencies money by reducing the cost of administrative litigation, while at the same time providing a fair outcome for all concerned. Assuming that the case is not resolved through alternative dispute resolution or otherwise, the administrative law judge presides over the hearing, at which, just as in a court case, witnesses testify under oath and are cross-examined and documents are submitted into evidence. After the hearing, the administrative law judge issues a written proposed decision, and the parties are given an opportunity to request changes by filing a proposal for action. The administrative law judge's decision is generally not the final decision, although in some instances, such as tax appeals, it is. Assuming the administrative law judge's decision is not given effect as the final decision, The administrative law judge's decision and any proposals for action are sent to the final decision maker, which in most cases is the commissioner of whatever department the agency is in, or in cases involving professional licensing or other boards and commissions, the board or commission involved. The final decision maker can either adopt the administrative law judge's decision, modify it, or send it back to the administrative law judge for additional proceedings. In the vast majority of cases, the final decision maker adopts the administrative law judge's decision in the form it was issued. In any event, once the final decision is issued, the parties to the case may appeal that decision to the Superior Court. That, in a nutshell, is how cases generally proceed in OAH. Over the course of years since the agency was created, however, it has identified a few provisions of its enabling statute that could be improved in order to streamline the adjudicative process and to clarify the agency's powers. SB 88 was drafted with the direct and close involvement of OAH and the Department of Law. Mr. Chairman, thank you for providing me with the opportunity to testify in support of SB 88. Administrative Law Judge Chris Kennedy, who was the primary OAH contact in the bill drafting process, will take the committee through the bill's provisions in detail. But in the meantime, if there are any questions for me, I'm happy to address them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hemingway. Do we have any questions from the committee? Yes, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Hemingway, for being here. I could just imagine the decision tree as you go down from point to point and then what happens next, and that's very helpful for me because I wasn't aware of the process. Can you tell me, so just these are just regular things I just like to know. Is a person who comes before the OAH, say for like child support or a PFD, do they typically have counsel with them?
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, it varies with the type of case. Generally, and for example, you ask about child support, typically no, they would not. PFD cases, typically not. The welfare benefit cases, again, typically not. In the cases where there's enough at stake in dollars or in principle to justify hiring an attorney, someone will show up with an attorney in hand. In fact, in the welfare cases, there are a number of times when we've had attorneys appearing, even though the amount of money isn't very big for this particular claimant, but the principle, if it's applied across the board, is going to make a big difference to a lot of Alaskans. So you'll see counsel in some of those cases. So it varies with the type of case.
That's great. And then through the chair.
Yes.
And I'm not sure if the statistics are in this the annual report or not, but can you tell me how many of the OAH cases typically are settled at that point, and then how many of them typically go on to the Superior Court?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, I can't give you that specific information. It is in the report, and I'm sure ALJ Kennedy is probably going to be able to give you specifics.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Kawasaki. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Hemingway. While you're there, we'll have Mr. Kennedy from the Office of Administrative Hearings, who is on the phone. Please walk us through the sectional, I think, is what you're planning on doing. Sir, are you on the phone? Could you hear me? Please put yourself on the record and respond.
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chris Kennedy, and I'm currently a tax administrative law judge with the Office of Administrative Hearings. And I think my task is to walk you through the bill. I could just very quickly answer Senator Kawasaki's question about the number of cases that proceed onto the Superior Court. I believe the percentage is less than 1% that go onto Superior Court, but we can get them the exact figure.
Please do for the committee, if you wouldn't mind sharing that with the committee, we would appreciate that greatly, sir.
Yes, sir. Okay. Just my background is that I've been with OAH since 2005, so I'm what passes for its institutional memory, and I was deputy chief until 2016. So I will try to walk you through these sections. Section 1 is just a conforming change since we're going to consolidate some of the section numbers farther down the bill. Section 2 is one of a pair of sections addressing an inadvertent problem created by our original statute. The statute did not authorize hiring of professional staff, such as a staff attorney, and other panels in other states have been able to multiply judge productivity by having junior lawyers do some of the more repetitive tasks. And if done right, this can be a way to reduce overall cost, and Section 2 would make that possible. So if we saw an opportunity to do it, we could do it. Section 3 corrects two anomalies in the chief administrative law judge's salary, but because of the applicability clause at the end of the bill, it would not apply to the current chief. Right now, the chief is paid on the Juneau salary schedule, but she's located in Anchorage, and that's one of the anomalies that this would correct. Also, the position is capped at Step F, which has effectively prevented governors from recruiting among senior attorneys at the Department of Law when selecting a chief ALJ because those individuals would lose too many steps in transferring to OAH. Now, as I said, the applicability clause would prevent this change from applying to the current chief, but if it did, it would actually reduce her salary in 2020. The current chief's term runs to 2024, and this change is aimed at rationalizing the salary provision for the next chief. Section 4 is the other part of the change I previously mentioned, which was to permit OAH the option of using professional staff. It also adds language in recognition that alternative dispute resolution, as Mr. Hemingway mentioned, has become one of the core duties of OAH. I don't believe this was fully foreseen in 2004, but we found that greatly expanding our mediation capabilities has been a tremendous cost-saving tool for us and has actually twice permitted us to downsize. And this section just updates our core duties to recognize that. The section also does some language cleanup that Ledge Legal recommended. Section 5 makes technical fixes. For example, the original statute permitted OAH to contract with municipalities and school districts, but it inadvertently didn't include them in the authorization for us to accept case referrals. We have accepted their case referrals, and that's been a significant win-win of cost savings to both munis and the state, but we wanted to put that on a solid statutory footing. Section 6 is in the same vein. It adds the word entity to make it clear that the option to delegate decision-making authority to OAH applies to everyone who sends us cases, not just agencies. So again, that's aimed at things like municipalities and school districts that don't quite fit the definition of agency. Section 7 is surprisingly important. Some of the most significant work OAH does, at least in my opinion as a tax judge, is acting as the state's tax court. And the way the statute is currently worded, we cannot hire tax judges unless they've been practicing law in Alaska for 2 years, even though Alaska experience is not really necessary for tax work. And frankly, it's just about impossible to find a good tax attorney in Alaska who's not already making a lot more money than we're able to pay. And we've had advertised positions go unfilled for over a year at a time. I'm the last employed tax judge at OAH, and I'm transitioning into retirement. So the organization would like the option to recruit for a replacement in other resource states if we can't find the right person locally. Section 8 corrects imprecise drafting in the 2004 bill so that if we have an agency or municipality's procedural powers in any proceeding, that the agency or municipality refers to us. It just makes it clear that we would have their powers when they refer a case to us. Section 9 is another technical correction. The current language seems to require even part-time judges to devote full-time to the office if they're serving in a position that's authorized to be full-time. As a cost-saving measure, we need to be able to do partial fills of full-time positions when case demand is down, and so this would just make it clear that we can do that. We can put somebody in a full-time position and have them work half-time. Section 10 is about the chief ALJ's duty to review code of conduct complaints against hearing officers all across the state system. And I should emphasize that this mostly most of the code of conduct complaints that we do review come from other tribunals, not from OAH. Right now, there's no statute of limitations on those code of conduct complaints, and disgruntled people can come in and complain about things that happened many years in the past. This limits the look-back period to 3 years, except that in a long-running proceeding, it gives you 2 years after the proceeding ends to bring a complaint about anything that happened in that particular proceeding. It's quite a generous statute of limitations, but at least it adds some outer boundaries to prevent stale complaints, which have been a problem in the past. Section 11 clarifies our existing preemption provision. Right now, the way the provision is written, if you read it literally, is a little too strong. And for example, it could be read to mean that if a municipality voluntarily refers a case to OAH, OAH regulations preempt the municipal hearing ordinances. What this Section 11 would do would make this language more precise so that agencies and municipalities can voluntarily refer cases to us without causing an override of their own hearing rules. Section 12 slightly modifies the referral process by requiring agencies to give us a little more basic information right at the time of referral so that we can get started with the case. But it also gives them a few more days to assemble the full agency record. This is a tweak based on practical experience of what is and isn't possible at the beginning of a case. This section also provides that if an agency denies the hearing and refuses to refer a case to OAH, the person requesting the hearing can appeal just that issue to OAH rather than having to go to the Superior Court. Again, this is a based on practical experience. This approach is already used through regulations in half of the OAH hearing docket, and it's been a quick and efficient way to resolve front-end disputes, such as whether the hearing request was timely. Section 13 addresses the way our 120-day timeline works. That timeline has been a tremendous tool in keeping OAH, in our opinion, as a faster, better, cheaper way to resolve a lot of kinds of cases. But there are times when you need to be able to stop the clock completely and allow a parallel criminal case or other court litigation to go first. Right now, we can't do that without both parties concurring, and getting that agreement can be cumbersome. So this would make it clear that we can stay a case if there's a court case that needs to go in front of us. All right. Now let's tackle Section 14, which is the most complicated one. As Andy Hemingway mentioned, we have a proposal for action process after our proposed decision is circulated. The current statute sets a hard 30-day timeline on these objections by the parties, and we can't extend that even if both sides agree and even if someone's in the hospital or deploying overseas. And this lets us manage that deadline like any other litigation deadline. There's also a problem with the proposal for action structure being a little too rigid, and we find that often one of the best features of the process is that when parties read the proposed decision, they finally realize what the key issues are, and they make their best arguments in the proposal for action. But in order to consider those arguments and still give due process, we need to be able to let the other party respond, and this lets us do that. It also lets us revise the proposed decision if we just to correct our own errors before we send them up to the final decision maker. Both of these changes will let us transmit a case to the final decision maker that's truly ready for final action rather than having to ask him or her to remand the case to us for more work. This section also addresses a major frustration that commissioners have expressed to us, which is that the deadline for final decision makers to act is currently tied to the wrong trigger. It's counted 45 days from the day we first mail the proposed decision to the parties, not when we send it to the final decision maker. And if parties take the full time to do their proposals for action, and then there's a few more days are consumed making sure we have those proposals for actions and then transmitting the file to the commissioner is sometimes left with only a few days to act. And in especially in complex cases, that can be very frustrating to them. If they don't act in time, they lose their opportunity to control the outcome of the case, and they feel that that's essentially usurps their jurisdiction. So what this section would do would be to count the commissioner's deadline from when the commissioner actually gets the case, which is the way almost every other deadline in the world is counted. Section 15 is a conforming change to recognize that what the final decision maker may be receiving is a revised proposed decision. Section 16 addresses a couple of very practical problems in case administration. First of all, right now we have subpoena authority in the majority of our cases, but it comes from literally dozens of different sources, and it has a lot of quirky variations. This simply gives us ordinary subpoena authority across the board. The main areas where it's been lacking have been TERS cases, public retirement cases, where hundreds of thousands of dollars can be at issue. But there was a drafting error in 2004 that inadvertently left out subpoena authority for cases like that. And also substantiation of child abuse, where litigants need to be able to compel testimony in order to get due process. Second, another frustration, practical frustration, has been the inability for commissioners or boards or commissions to reopen a decision that's been issued in error. And to give you a classic example of that, it's when a decision has been entered by default because a party didn't appear, and then we discover that the address for the party that was defaulted, we had the wrong address for them, and they didn't get notice. Right now, the only way to fix that is to make a trip to Superior Court, and Section 16 would create a standard system for reopening cases that's parallel to what's used in the court system. Just lets errors be corrected at the same level that they were made. Section 17 tweaks language but doesn't change the underlying meaning. The old language was hard to read because it used the word agency to mean two different things at the same time. Section 18 is a technical change. It was intended that OAH would be taking cases from municipalities and other governmental entities outside the executive branch, but they were inadvertently omitted from the definition of administrative hearing, so this just fixes that. Section 19 adds clarifying definitions, and in particular, there was a phrase in the 2004 legislation, quote, other proceeding, and that was used quite a bit, but it's an especially vague phrase, and it was undefined, so now it's being given a definition. Section 20 repeals the existing section on municipal and school district referrals because the way the bill's been structured, that would fold all of that material into other sections. Section 21 is the applicability clause that I mentioned that makes the salary changes for the chief ALJ not apply to the incumbent. And it also makes sure that the statute of limitations for code of conduct complaints would operate prospectively. And then Section 22, the last one, delays the statute of limitations effective date, which protects its constitutionality so that the people would have noticed that a statute of limitations was coming into effect. And that's all I have in terms of walking you through the statute. I'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. Do we have questions from the committee? I have a question, Mr. Kennedy. Do you have any comments on the change that requires administrative law judges to be licensed in the state for 4 rather than 2 years before serving in this capacity? And forgive me if I missed that.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I did not mention that. Yes, we have found that it's important for people to have quite a bit of experience before becoming administrative law judges. In fact, we normally you want to have people with about 10 years of experience. The requirement of only 2 years of experience seemed insufficient, and so that was meant to be an essentially non-controversial recognition of just the basic experience that's required to preside over the kind of cases that we have.
Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. Any other questions? Yes, Senator Coghill.
Looks like you've already done some work for municipalities, but has there been struggles getting payment, or is it just struggles getting things on the docket?
It's just been that I don't think Senator Coghill through the chair. I'm sorry that I think the struggles have been that the original legislation probably didn't. This was a bit of an afterthought, and the original legislation didn't address that area sufficiently. In fact, in the last few years, it's worked in the practical world. It's worked very well. A number of the smaller municipalities have found that they it's a tremendous cost savings for them to be able to essentially fire and forget, simply send their procurement cases or their tax cases to OAH, where they'd be heard by someone with a lot of experience and heard quickly and efficiently. And we've had no trouble at all getting payment. We charge them the full cost of hearing their cases, and they seem to be delighted to pay it.
A follow-up?
Thank you, and I think this is a good fix. One of the things we don't hear much of, and maybe you could explain to us, what would be the anticipated school district work? Would that be primarily retirement system issues, or would that be the whole range of issues?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, we have been getting some teacher discipline and retirement cases in the last year from school districts, so I think that's a growing area. But we also take special education cases from them, and where there can be litigation over the rights of people that have special education services. So it's a variety of things that can come from school districts, again, many of them are small entities that don't really have the ability to have an in-house hearing unit. So it's nice for them to be able to get the economies of scale that come by referring their cases to something like OAH.
So I noticed, Mr. Chairman, if I might.
No, please.
One other question. We changed alternate to alternative dispute resolution, and my guess is that's a term of art, but we do describe it in here. Can you give us kind of a methodology primer on alternative dispute resolution?
Yeah. Senator Coghill, through the chair, first of all, I think the grammarians told us that alternate was meant to be something switching back and forth, and alternative was giving somebody a different choice. So they made us change it to alternative, and there are two ways we do that. In our more complex cases, often the parties will ask for us to appoint an administrative law judge as a mediator, and we choose a different judge and someone who will be completely walled off from the administrative law judge who's hearing the case. And then that person comes in and meets with the parties and tries to work out a solution. And we've found that's because we have such a broad tour of state government in running a central tribunal like this, that our ALJs have the kind of multidisciplinary knowledge to be able to put together complicated solutions to some of the complicated cases that might involve multiple agencies. So it's been I don't think it was really foreseen at the beginning, but it's been a great way to solve cases without the expense of litigation and again, get to a result that everyone is happy with. The other piece of that has been in the public benefits area. We We ended up learning from another state, North Carolina, a technique for running very, very fast track, 1 hour mediations run by a professional mediator before anyone gets anywhere close to a hearing. The people are automatically put into a mediation track and get mediation about 10 days to 2 weeks after they file their appeals. And it had a settlement rate of 85%, and it just knocked the stuffing out of that case category to the point where we actually had to lay someone off because it reduced our caseload so much in the public benefits area. And that's a good thing in terms of saving money for us and for primarily the Medicaid system. And the feedback from the public is very good. They like the process, the informal process in which a mediator can kind of help them through the understanding how the system works. And even if they don't get the result they were asking for in their appeal, they at least understand well how it came to be that they can't have what they want. So that's been a particularly successful type of mediation for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I only have one other question, if it's all right.
Yes, Senator Cockrell.
In the new section, Section 16, we're talking about your subpoena authority. You already had some authority. What is new in this subpoena authority that I thought you already had some of that? So explain to me what's new here.
Senator Coghill, through the chair, the way the original legislation was done, it gave us whatever powers, including subpoena powers, that the referring agency had, and probably the majority of state agencies have subpoena power of some kind. So, for example, in the professional licensing area, those cases are mostly under the Administrative Procedure Act, and there's full subpoena authority in the Administrative Procedure Act. And in the tax area, there's a subpoena authority somewhere in Title 43 and in the and so forth. But some of this subpoena authority is phrased in strange ways in the agency statutes. So to give you an example, I think in the public benefits area there's subpoena authority, but it sounds as though it may only apply to documents, or that it may only apply to investigations, and there can be some litigation or some argument over whether it transfers to an entity like OIH. And then there's some quirky areas where there just isn't subpoena authority, and I think the most troublesome one has been in the PERS-TERS area. We were supposed to inherit all the powers of the PERS board and the TERS board, but that particular provision, the provision that gave them subpoena authority, did not get transferred over when the original legislation was drafted, and that problem's never been fixed. And then back in those days, there really weren't any administrative hearings regarding people being put on the registry for child abuse and neglect. And now those kind of cases are a significant part of our docket. And I think there's a fairly universal feeling that subpoena power is needed because people who are accused of child abuse or neglect need to be able to compel witnesses to testify in their defense, and yet we just haven't been able to find any source in the health and social health and human services statutes for us to issue subpoenas in that area. So what this would do is just, instead of having to search around or cobble things together, this would just give a one-size-fits-all subpoena authority. You don't have to use it very often, but when you need it, you really need it, and it's nice to have it be clear.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was new to me. I thought you had that authority already, but that's a good explanation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Coghill. Mr. Kennedy, any other questions? Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kennedy, for being online. And just one other question. This deals with increasing the final decision-making power of the Office of Administrative Hearings. There's a partial, or maybe it's a full list, of mandatory jurisdiction of which OAH has jurisdiction over on page 4 and 5 of the report. And there's probably a half a dozen or a dozen that which you already have the final decision-making authority. And so does this bill essentially mean that every case category will now be included in the final decision-making authority?
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, I'm glad you asked that, because that's this bill actually doesn't address that at all. I know in the annual report, Chief Administrative Law Judge Frederick advocated that our final decision-making authority be expanded, meaning that cases would not go to in some cases, at least, the decisions would not go to commissioners or boards or commissions to make the final decision. But this bill leaves all of that as it is. It does not expand our final decision-making authority.
Great. Thank you for the clarification, Mr. Kennedy. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. We're going to set this bill aside. Oh, I'm sorry. We're going to open up public testimony. Public testimony is now open. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? Okay, seeing none. There's none online. We're going to leave public testimony open, and would encourage amendments to be sent before Monday the 16th of this month, if you have any ideas for amendments. So this time we're going to set this bill aside, and we're going to move on to SB 231, an act requiring background investigations of the village public safety officer applicants by the Department of Public Safety relating to the Village Public Safety Officer Program and providing for an effective date. I'd like to invite Senator Olson and his staff. Senator Olson is on his way. We will take a brief at ease. Donnie Olson and his staff, Denise Licioli, to please put yourselves on the record and tell us about your bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and distinguished members of the committee. My name is Donald Olson. I'm the state senator from District T, and this afternoon I have my chief of staff with me.
My name is Denise Licioli, and I'm staff to Senator Olson.
We are here to go ahead and present Senate Bill 231, which has to do with the VPSO program that is so essential to rural communities in the state of Alaska. The VPSO program was created in the late 1970s to assist in the protection of life and property and to coordinate probation and parole in these rural communities. In the past decade, there's been shrinking numbers of VPSOs, significant difficulty in recruitment and retention of VPSOs, and the community needs that surpass the current number of VPSOs that are on duty. In order to start addressing this crisis in public safety in rural Alaska, last spring, Senator Giesel, President of the Senate, and House Speaker Edgman, Speaker of the House, appointed a VPSO working group and tasked it with finding ways to improve the VPSO program. Representative Kopp and myself were appointed as co-chairs of the VPSO working group. The group met several times over the interim with the VPSO coordinators throughout the state, as well as the Department of Public Safety. The results of these meetings are summarized in a report that was finalized in January 2020, which included recommendations for the first phase of changes recommended to improve the program. This legislation implements the recommendations contained in the report, with the exception of the recommendation for an increase in funding, which must be done through an appropriation bill. One of the biggest changes would be to transfer the grant management and oversight function to the Department of Community, to the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. They are the natural department for this, since they do exactly that for various varieties of grant programs. The state police standards, training, and oversight functions will remain under the Department of Public Safety. While all parties agree that even more will need to be done if we are going to have a strong and vibrant VPSO program, this is a first step in laying the groundwork for more to come in this vital program. With that, Mr. Chairman, I have myself as well as Leonard Wallner on the line to answer questions, and if there's time, he'd actually like to have additional testimony on this very vital program. He's the VPSO manager for Chugach-Mut and is acting as a spokesman for all the VPSO coordinators in the state. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Are there questions for the sponsor? Okay, I think.
No.
Okay.
But, Mr. Chairman, before we get to that, were we going to have him go through the section of the bill, or do you want to do this first?
Yeah, are you prepared
yes,
to go through? Okay, yeah, let's do that. Walk through the sectional, please, if you would, Ms. Licholi.
For the record, my name is Denise Licholi again, staff to Senator Olson. And I believe you all have the written one, and because it is a little bit complicated, I'll basically almost entirely be reading it, but I have other references to the more specific line numbers and such that you might want to know. So starting with Section 1, which is contained on pages 1 to 3 of the bill, that section amends AS 1262-400, which has to do with criminal background checks, and adds the VPSO program as a program the Department of Public Safety is authorized to secure background checks for. And where you can find them being added is on page 3, lines 19 and 20. The rest of those first couple of pages is what is already existing in law. Section 2, which begins on page 3, line 21, relates to Section 1 and amends AS 1865-080, which is one of public safety's enabling statutes. And this amendment requires that the department secure the background checks for VPSO personnel as they're being hired or potentially being hired. So Sections 1 and 2 combined help to implement Recommendation 2 that's found in the VPSO Working Group report. Section 3 begins on page 3. The current statute has only one statute, and it's very broad. It's not very specific. So this particular Section 3 is going to add a lot of subsections that basically bring in things that are in regulation. So in each of those subsections, I've tried to note when there is a regulation that's being brought forward, and I also provided you a copy of the regulations relating to the VPSO program. So beginning on page 3, line 29, subsection A was rewritten to incorporate the duties and functions that VPSOs are currently performing but are not codified in the existing statute. And this, again, relates to recommendation 1. Subsection B is mostly similar, but it has been updated to include references to the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, also called DCCED or the Department of Commerce for simplicity. And this is to include federal recognized tribes or as organizations that can be awarded a VPSO grant. And that is in conjunction with recommendation 6 in the report. Subsection C is new and is the statutory codification of current DPS regulation 13 AAC 96020. It just has changes to reflect that it will be DCCED that performs the financial management of the program, but otherwise it's very similar to that regulation. Subsection D begins on page 5, line 9, and it's the statutory codification of the regulation 13 AAC 96030, and it also has changes to reflect that DCCED will be performing the financial management of the grants. Further changes in this particular section remove the prohibition of existing 13 AAC 96030 subparagraph 2, which prevents the payment of bonuses from other non-VPSO grant revenue sources. In the past, there have been times when, because of recruitment difficulties, some of the grantees have wanted to pay a bonus, and they were prohibited from doing so because of that regulation stating that they had to stay, they couldn't exceed the salary and benefits schedule. So in this particular section, we left that part off so that that they can do that and when they need to due to recruitment difficulties. Subsection E is the partial statutory codification of the current regulation 13 AAC 96040 and also 050, with changes to reflect that DCCED will be performing the financial management of the grants. And further changes within that existing regulation, that villages receiving a VPSO placement must provide the office space, phone, and holding cell. And so this, in conjunction with subparagraph K, a little further down, makes it clear that these costs can be paid from the VPSO grantees' funds that they're awarded. In the past, again, they haven't been able to use that. They've had to come up with it on their own, and that alone has been one of the reasons that they've, in some cases, they've had trouble with their recruiting or retention of their VPSOs. Subsection F starts on page 5, line 23. And it's, again, the partial codification of 13 AAC 96040, specifically subparagraph A2, which sets the overall policy that a VPSO is generally assigned to one village, but if the grantee organization requests additional VPSO personnel per village, then they can do so. The changes reflect a more neutral and less harsh tone than the language from the regulation. And this is because sometimes they need to basically share a VPSO, and some villages might have at least a temporary need to have more than one VPSO for some reason or another at a time. And in the past, they would have been prohibited because of the way the regulation currently is written. Subsection G starts on page 5, line 27, and it relates to 13 AAC 96040 also. It can be found in the working group's report under Appendix 2, and this provision allows for traveling or roving VPSO personnel who are permitted to itinerate between villages within a grantee's region as the public safety needs arise. And so, again, that has to do with recommendations 1, 2, and 9 coming from the report. Subsection H is also a codification of the regulation 13 AAC 96040. Specifically subparagraph B, that relate to DCCED performing the financial management of the grants and also awarding record-keeping requirements and or other grant management requirements as the Department of Commerce would require. Subsection I contains new regulation adopting authority for the DPS commissioner, subject to the new consultation requirements of the new subsection L following a little further down in the bill. And again, these relate to recommendations 1, 2, and 8 of the report. Subsection J allows the funding grantee organization's indirect rates to up to a statewide average of 35%. This language has been used as intent language in several prior operating budget bills. So this would partially implement recommendations 2, 4, and 5, One of the bigger problems some of the regions have had is because their indirect cost rates are very high, whereas some others are low. So this allows them to go up to 35% of the total of all of the regions, not just a particular region. Subsection K provides explicit instruction to DCCED commissioner on grant disbursement, specifically that grant disbursement is to be timely and not to be unreasonably withheld. Subsections L and M also relate to subsection I, and they provide for a consultation and negotiated rulemaking process for when any of the three state agencies involved with the program exercise their regulation adopting authority. This is intended to prevent, well, it would have to be one of the two state agencies, those being DCCED or DPS, putting in regulations something that hasn't been discussed with the VPSO coordinators that are affected by it. So it requires them to work together. Then Section 4, which begins on page 8, line 7, creates new statutes. 1865-672 codifies the current DPS regulation 13 AAC 96080, which has to do with VPSO qualifications. And then 1865-674 codifies the regulation 13 AAC 96.090, dealing with the VPSO background checks. 1865-676 codifies regulation 13 AAC 96100, dealing with the VPSO training requirements. 1865-678 codifies current regulation 13 AAC 96040, subparagraph E8, and also 13 AAC 96100, dealing with VPSO firearm training requirements. 1865-682 is a codification of 13 AAC 96110, dealing with VPSO certification. That's an important one, too, because you can hire a VPSO, and they have 24 months to get certified and go through all of their training. And so because a VPSO has more than just police in their police services in their duties, this would allow them to do things like search and rescue or other things that they may be required to do as a VPSO, which is a little bit different than what a trooper is. So they have 24 months from when they're hired to get their training and certification that they need to be able to carry out police work on their own independently. In between that time, they can go with a trooper, but they can't do it on their own without that certification. So, following then, I'm now on page 12, line 15. 1865-684 codifies regulation 13 AAC 96120. It deals with the denial, revocation, or lapse of a VPSO certificate. And finally, 1865-686 is a definition section for the new statutory requirement. So all these things were in regulation before, and now they're being brought into the statutes. Section 5 begins on page 14, line 15, and it adds a new paragraph to the DCCED duties to accommodate the VPSO grant management functions being moved into their department from DPS. Section 6, which is also on page 14, creates a standard grandfather provision for existing VPSO personnel who might have been certified under previous rules, and then due to different training requirements, they might not qualify now because of that. So if they were previously certified, it grandfathers in. And then Section 7, which is also on page 14, beginning on line 25, creates a requirement that DPS continue its current level of interaction between itself and the VPSO personnel. It's currently codified in VPSO Statute 1865-670, subparagraph C, and the language relating to the DPS regulation authority extending to the interaction between the Department of Public Safety and Village Public Safety officers. So, and then finally, the last two sections. Section 8 provides that the grant application requirements transferring to DCCED take effect July 1st, 2020. and Section 9 provides that all other sections of the bill have an immediate effective date to allow them to start preparing for that. So, and that completes the sectional analysis. I would like to state that again, Mr. Wallner, who should be online, if you had any specifics, questions about any of those requirements or what they currently do or what this, how this bill would change that, he would be probably the best person to ask.
Thank you, Ms. Lacholi. Do we have any questions for the sponsor? All right, I think we'll have invited testimony, and we'll start with Leonard Wallner, the VPSO coordinator. Sir, are you there? If you can hear me, please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, sir. My name is Leonard Wallner, VPSO coordinator for Chugach-Mute, which is a tribal consortium representing Prince William Sound and Lower Cook Inlet. One of the current 10 grantees presently operating under the VPSO program. First and foremost, Chair Rivak, committee members, I'd like to thank you for listening to, giving me a chance to present before you and taking your time to listen to what I have to say. A little bit about myself first. I am 25 years with the Alaska State Troopers, retired the last 9 years of my time with the troopers. I worked as the statewide coordinator under Captain Merrill and his predecessor with the statewide VPSO program office. Retired in 2016 and took a position, my current position with Chugach-Mute, where I've been ever since. What I'd like to bring up first is as far as need and the effect for the proposed changes. There have been few changes to the statute since original creation inception back in 1979. The VPSO program has evolved considerably, and updating of statutes, it's come to the point where it's not a matter, it's a necessity. Updates need to be made. Primary points of, well, let me say this. On behalf of Chugach-Mute and through the Alaska Tribal Caucus, we support the bill in entirety, and primary points of support I'd like to get to is, number one, the ability to tailor the program structure for each grantee and region within the state. The flexibility to reprogram funding from year to year, the elimination of unfunded mandates that could not be met in the past, and in addition to that, the clarification of the VPSO duties and responsibilities, as well as the ability to conduct investigations, which is definitely applicable. The language in the bill speaks to that, and bearing, of course, that as a training component comes into play, because that plays a significant role. With that said, I am at your calling to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Mr. Wallner, do we have any questions from committee members? All right, thank you for your testimony. Seeing none, we'll move on to invited testimony from Commissioner Price from the Department of Public Safety. Commissioner Price, are you there? Could you please put yourself on the record if you are and begin your testimony?
Good afternoon, sir. For the record, my name is Amanda Price, Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. I would just like to start by acknowledging that while this legislation has been moving through the process, this is the first time that DPS has been invited to provide testimony and input on this public safety bill. So, Chair Rivak, I just wanted to extend my great thanks to you and to the committee for the partnership that you are showing in inviting us to participate. The mission of the Department of Public Safety is to ensure public safety with resources deployed throughout the state. In order to accomplish this mission and protect the life and property of Alaskans, DPS is committed to working across the state with numerous other law enforcement professionals, varieties of communities, all lawmakers and stakeholders, and we are always seeking opportunities to collaborate on solutions that will increase public safety. We all recognize that rural public safety has been a challenge to our state since statehood, and while there's a lot of progress that's been occurring recently, and particularly with the hiring of 44 state troopers last year and the hire of 15 Alaska state troopers that are currently in the academy that will be deployed to our rural communities, there's a great deal of work that needs to be done. Increasing the number of officers in a larger number of communities is the core goal and vision that DPS has. This legislation specifically addresses the village public safety officer statutes and came at the recommendations of the VPSO working group, which was tasked with specifically reviewing and strengthening the VPSO program. However, for the consumption of the committee, DPS would like to offer partnership in engaging in a larger conversation about how we can improve rural public safety outside of just one program. The DPS has submitted in writing to all bill sponsors feedback, challenges, and recommendations to address the challenges with the bill as written. I will summarize for the committee what was written, what that written input included, but Chair Rivak, if you are interested, I would be happy to provide to the committee through you that written feedback that has been provided to bill sponsors to date. The bill moves the administration of the VPSO program to the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. In the spirit of meeting the working group's recommendation, DPS has actively engaged in conversations with DCCED to immediately move the grant oversight over to that department. We are experiencing a bit of administrative delay in transferring and doing an RSA of funding to that department, but we are actively working to transfer the grant administration right now and anticipate having that done soon. The bill opens up eligible grant applicants to include all federally recognized tribes. DPS supports this expansion and believes tribes receiving direct funding to hire their own community members to serve as officers could be very beneficial to public safety in Alaska. Moving from only 10 eligible grant applicants to more than 200 will create some hiccups and some challenges in the back end of administering the grant, but I certainly believe that with some support we can accomplish that. One concern that brings to the surface is that the bill as written includes eligible applicants of municipalities with less than 10,000 people. That includes larger communities such as Kenai, Soldotna, and others. Not only does that seem to conflict with the spirit of the Village Public Safety Officer Program, but it also creates jurisdictional concerns, as many of those larger municipalities have existing police departments. Another area of challenge is related to liability insurance. Insurance companies have been unwilling to insure non-law enforcement entities, which in this case are the grantees, with coverage for those employees that are conducting law enforcement functions. There is only one company that has been willing to insure VPSOs. DPS has not had adequate time to vet the implication of expanding the program to include the federally recognized tribes, and we are engaged in attempting to get some more information from that company on what the impact may be, and there might be a fiscal note associated when we secure that information. The bill, as written, adds a layer of what appears to be a great deal of complexity to an already complex program, and some of that complexity, I believe, can be clarified with additional conversation. Some of the issues that the bill, as written, create, DPS, as the current operating entity, just needs to understand the intent of the sponsor and the legislature. Specifically, one such challenge is DPS is not sure what is meant by DPS participating in, quote, monitoring public safety performance, end quote, of VPSOs. This is an area that DPS has historically been challenged with. The village public safety officers are not state employees, and DPS cannot influence the performance even if there is a noticed and identified performance-related issue. Clarification on how DPS would be monitoring the public safety performance would be needed. Clarification is also needed on what is referenced in the bill as a background investigation, as opposed to the fingerprint clearance check that DPS and DCCED would be completing. Additionally, in the bill, DPS and DCCED are required to complete annual reviews on performance of grantees, and there are a variety of other technical and logistical challenges that are listed throughout the bill that DPS could benefit from some clarification on. And Chair Rivak, those concerns we'd be happy to provide to you in writing or provide at your request the written response that we have previously put forward to bill sponsors. The DPS does not support this legislation as written. There are three core reasons why DPS does not support the bill as written, and they all circulate around candidates who are eligible to become village public safety officers under this bill being having the ability to have felony convictions. DPS does not support candidates with felony convictions serving as peace officers. That, coupled with the expansion of authority that the bill gives VPSOs to investigate felony crimes and the amount of time that a VPSO can be hired before they receive training, creates for a great deal of challenge. The bill, as written, allows for a convicted felon on active parole to be investigating a felony crime with little or no training. For further example, under the current way that the bill is written, someone convicted of child pornography who is on parole can be hired as a village public safety officer and can be investigating child pornography. On that point, there's an additional concern as it relates to the 10 years since conviction of felony that is identified in the bill. The bill does not indicate that it should be 10 years since unconditional discharge, but instead 10 years since conviction, which means that someone could be convicted, serve the sentence, be released, and be on parole and eligible to serve as a village public safety officer. There are some felonies that are excluded, but there are a variety of other felonies that the Department of Public Safety views to be very damaging to improving public safety in our communities, to include drug dealing, and there are a number of crimes that would require a qualified applicant for VPSO to be registered as a sex offender at the same time that they are serving as a village public safety officer. There are just numerous scenarios that could play out when opening up the door to have convicted felons serve as peace officers. The DPS would also be very interested in the Department of Law's analysis on how having a convicted felon complete a felony investigation may impact the criminal justice process in court. We know from real-time experience that the law enforcement professional and the character of that professional becomes critically important in criminal cases, and the integrity of the data and testimony provided becomes of critical importance to benefit a positive outcome in a court case. DPS certainly supports the need to increase the number of officers serving in rural Alaska, but does not believe that lowering standards of those serving in positions of significant authority in our most rural communities serves the interests of public safety. The DPS would like to encourage that all felony convictions be disqualifying to candidates for village public safety officer. In addition to peace officers needing to be of good moral character, there are a number of practical concerns with village public safety officers having a felony record. One such concern is access to various systems that contain criminal justice information. This access is necessary for VPSOs to perform their job function, and it is determined by federal law. That access cannot be granted to anyone with a felony conviction. Another concern with felony convictions is firearms. Convicted felons are federally prohibited from possessing a firearm. Even if they don't carry a firearm as a VPSO, if in the course of their duties they are required to seize a firearm, a felon who is federally prohibited from possessing a firearm would be in violation of federal law when they seize that firearm. The bill, as written, allows for VPSOs to serve for 24 months with no training. It is true that existing regulations have that same time requirement, but the DPS is concerned that with the expansion of authority that this bill gives to VPSOs, particularly the opportunity to investigate felony crimes like homicide and sexual assault, that having a VPSO in community for 24 months without adequate training would be very damaging. In closing, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to thank the committee again for inviting the department to provide input and feedback on this bill. We have done a great deal of analysis on this and are really happy to collaborate and partner on any of the areas that have created a bit of confusion for us, and we look forward to moving the grant administration component over to Commerce, hopefully working with tribes. We've received a great number of tribes that have reached out to the department who are eager to potentially secure funding through the appropriation, and we are very eager to see how that plays out. I also have in the room with me the Director of Statewide Services, Kathy Monfreda, as well as the Village Public Safety Officer Commander, Captain Andrew Merrill, and we are all here to answer any questions if the committee has any.
Thank you, Commissioner Price. Do we have any questions from members of the committee? Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Commissioner Price. I see the letter that you wrote is dated March 4th. Was there any time that you got to work with the recommendation, or the committee that was putting these recommendations together? Did they reach out to you on a variety of these issues?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, the department was invited to the first meeting with the work group, but subsequent meetings we were not participant in, and we were not invited to provide testimony during the House committee meetings or provide really input until we saw the final product.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Olson.
Can we have an answer to the question that was asked?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I would love to have Senator Olson share with us, because I think they're trying to be as collaborative as possible. Please, Mr. Chairman, if we could have Mr. Olson, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. Yes, Mr. Olson, please.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for this opportunity. I realize it's a little out of character to, or out of the normal procedure to go ahead and have a chance to go ahead and answer that, but actually my Chief of Staff, Ms. Lucioli, has an answer to the letter dated March 4th that the commissioner just commented on.
Okay. Is that something, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, please, yes.
I know that's only been, 6 days or so. Is that something that we'll be seeing in the committee? So I'm sorry I assumed something there, and I want to give the commissioner the benefit of having these concerns work through. Looks like we'll be working through them in the committee. Maybe we can get the staff to answer how they're going to deal with these concerns.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. Yeah, is that something that you would rather provide verbally? We certainly would like that in writing. If you'd like to address verbally quickly now, we only have a few minutes to the end of the...
I think we can go ahead and talk to verbally and then give you something in writing shortly there.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Denise Lacholi against after Senator Olson. And I'd like to start by saying that I actually just got a copy of that letter this morning. It did not come to my inbox or Senator Olson's, but I found out actually when I saw it on the documents for this hearing. So it's a very long letter, and I haven't had a chance to thoroughly review it. But one thing that I was remiss in when I gave the sectional, I meant to say that because this bill was dropped in, we were trying to meet the deadline for personal bills that actually went in on the very last day. We knew that we had some other changes that we wanted to incorporate, for one thing. And then also since then, we found just some errors. Some of them would be called drafting errors or conceptual errors. And so we are working on doing either some amendments or a blank CS. I spoke to the committee aide to let her know that we would be having that coming. And in that, we will be incorporating some of the recommendations of the commissioner. There are some others that may not be incorporated because they might just simply need a clarification at some level or for some other reason. So we're still working through that whole list, and our office is working with the sponsor of the companion bill in the House come to an agreement on both so that we're not doing two different things, that we're going straight down the line, because they were the co-chairs for the working group. So we do intend to incorporate certainly the most serious things that were mentioned, as well as some others.
Well, thank you, Ms. Lucioli. And from this committee's perspective, we just want to get it right. Aside from what the other body is doing, we want to make sure that our product is right out of here. And so, and I fully support the intent of this bill, and that's why we have these hearings, is to hash this stuff out and get it right. So I think this has been a great start, and I think what we're going to do, before, so we just have, we have a few minutes left, and then we're going to set this aside, and we're going to ask for any amendment requests to be submitted by Monday the 16th, no later than. And before we leave, we do have Mayor Lucy Nelson from the Northwest Arctic Borough in the room. And so she came all this way. We absolutely want to give her the floor. Madam Mayor, if you'd please put yourself on the record and tell us your thoughts.
Yes, good evening. Mayor Lucy Nelson, recently elected as mayor of Northwest Arctic Borough in November, but I sat on the assembly for 8 years, so I'm very familiar with the programs that we serve our people. We serve about 7,700 folks throughout the 11 communities in Northwest Arctic. We currently manage the VPSO program since 2011. It used to be under Manilik Association. And the administration and assembly support HB 287. There are several recommendations that we support that we want to speak on. And we do have some of our assembly here and administration. Vice President Dude Lincoln Carr, Nathan Hadley is the president of our assembly, Sandy Shorier Beaver, she's a member of our assembly, Austin Swan, member, and Nate Koch is director of public services, and Reggie Jewell III, assembly. Travel all this way to lobby, but we've managed this program for many years, and we had the legislative working group come to Kotzebue to sit with our public safety commission to address the issues we believe need to be changed within the VPSO program. We do not have the financial flexibility to manage the monies. In 2018, we had $1.3 million in the budget, which allowed us to have seven VPSOs, which included a coordinator. We have 11 communities, Kotzebue being the only community that has a police force. And we have 10 communities that currently don't have a skilled VPSO. We have one candidate attending this VPSO training. So our residents are coming to us. They don't feel safe. We don't have a presence in every community, and we need to have that presence. I mean, could you imagine an elder calling 911 and nobody's there? You got to wait for Alaska State Troopers to come in because they got to fly in. We have VPSOs or VPSOs who serve as the first responders. So this bill is really important to us. You know, we want to be able to protect our residents and protect our children and our mothers and fathers. And so we really hope that this HB 27 passes through. Thank you. And we'd like to ask that the 2018 budget be restored back to its normal funding. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Nelson. We really appreciate your testimony. Do we have any questions? Senator Coghill.
First of all, thank you. And I think with from the national attention to your down to the mayor attention, we want to get this one right. And as you could hear from our public safety commissioner, some concerns. I think we'll have to work on this one. We'll see how the timing can go. I think you're right on the funding part, probably more than us being able to get everything exactly right in this. But I think what you guys do as a community, hats off to you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you. I would second that. In the times I've been able to visit the Northwest Arctic Borough, and I don't think Mr. Hatch is there anymore, but I spent some time with Mr. Hatch out there and was very impressed with the – very impressed by what you folks were doing that way.
We've had to – Chair, we've had to reestablish the VPSO program, and we're working on rebuilding that program so that we can have young people come in, our folks from outside – we have the people. We just need the funding.
Well, thank you, Mayor Nelson. I think that's a good place to end today's meeting. I'd like to again thank all the folks who traveled all this way. I hope you enjoy your time in the Capitol. Thanks to all those folks who testified, and thank you, Senator Olson, for bringing us your bill. Again, Monday the 16th, ideas for amendments, please, no later than. And we're going to hold this till next time. Our next meeting will be held this Thursday, the 12th at 3:30 p.m. Presently on the schedule is SB 210 license plates, SB 209 driver's license and identification cards for inmates, and potentially previously scheduled legislation. This meeting is adjourned at 4:57 p.m.